My dear friends, in discussing what is justice, it is well to distinguish at the outset between legal justice and ideal justice. The two are, of course, not synonymous. There is a difference which can be observed almost daily between law and ideal morality. Law represents the minimum of moral requirements which a community at any given time and at any given stage in its development regards as absolutely indispensable. Law reflects the average morality of a society. Thus, for example, there are laws and the statute books of our federal, state, and municipal governments which are clearly inferior to the moral sentiments of the best elements among our people. Law frequently lags behind ideal justice, though it often tries to catch up with it. The moral idealism of a people tries to bring its laws into conformity with the ideal moral standard. It is quite difficult, therefore, and unprofitable to seek to determine what is justice by reference to a people's legal code, a code of laws. Represents, in a sense, what has already been achieved. But ideal justice represents society's outreaching for perfection. The path of the just shines more and more unto the perfect day, as the Bible says, Holech va'or ad nechon hayom. Even in legal justice, justice dispensed in the courtroom, there has been marked progress in recent times. In the past, society assumed that a man's wrongdoing was exclusively the result of his deliberate evil intentions. And the wrongdoer was entirely to blame, therefore, for his wrongdoing. And society was justified in inflicting maximum punishment upon him because he is a willful violator of its laws. But our more recent studies in sociology, more particularly our studies in the fields of psychology, have convinced men that there is such a thing as social partnership in crime. That the community is, in a sense, partly responsible for the actions of the individual. Often a man's wrongdoing is the result not of his evil intention, but of an evil environment, an evil preconditioning, an evil upbringing. A man is frequently driven to do wrong by forces over which he has no control. And as a result of this new knowledge which has come to us, our entire philosophy of crime and punishment has undergone a radical change in the last few decades. We conceive of justice today less in terms of the punitive and more in terms of the corrective, and not so much corrective as preventive. Today, justice seeks a change in the social conditions, environment, to a point where they will help the individual to observe the laws and keep him from perpetrating anti-social acts. Now, this sound and commendable view, of course, has its dangers of its own. Some have come to believe that the individual is altogether without blame or responsibility altogether, that when he commits a crime, the blame is entirely upon society and not the individuals. And this extreme point of view leads, of course, to moral anarchy. The proper mean for justice is to take into account all extenuating circumstances, but at the same time, to hold fast to the basic dogma upon which all morality is ultimately based, namely, that a normal individual is responsible for his own action. Now, we can go to the law books and find out what legal justice is in any given case. But where shall we find a definition of ideal justice? Frankly, it is very difficult to find such a definition. From the days of Plato to our own day, philosophers and students of ethics have sought to evolve a formula which would adequately define ideal justice. But no consensus has as yet been reached on such a formula. Take our Bible, for example. There are no writings anywhere in the world which are so completely devoted to the subject of ideal justice as our biblical literature. Almost every page rings with it. And yet, nowhere in the Bible will you find a concise definition of what really constitutes justice. Throughout the immortal preachments of the prophets, the cry for justice, of course, reverberates, and a very exalted conception of justice it is, alike for rich and poor, for subject and ruler, for native born and stranger. Thus, for example, when the great King David sinned, the prophet Nathan did not hesitate to go to him and, pointing an accusing finger at him, cry out, "Thou art the man." And when King Ahab robbed Naboth of his vineyard and had him put to death, the prophet Elijah did not hesitate to go to King Ahab, denounce him to his face, and proclaim doom upon him. It is told in the Talmud of the head of the Sanhedrin, Simeon ben Shetach, a famous Pharisaic teacher who lived in the first century before the Common Era. Simeon ben Shetach was such a stern, rigorous, and implacable defender of the law that he made many enemies. And one day, two of his enemies conspired to bear false witness against his son for a crime punishable by death. And on the basis of their false testimony, the son of Simeon ben Shetach was condemned to death. As he was being led to the place of execution, he protested his innocence so loudly that the witnesses who accompanied him. And according to the rule and the law, the witnesses had to accompany the condemned man to his execution. But the witnesses who accompanied him repented and confessed that they had borne false testimony against him. The judges who had sentenced him were ready to reverse their sentence. And even the father, Simeon ben Shetach, this rigorous, stern, and implacable defender of the law, now convinced of his son's innocence, was ready to reverse the sentence. But there was an ancient law in Israel which refused to accept the recantation of witnesses after sentence had been declared. Witnesses who had once given their testimony could not be trusted when later on they reversed their own testimony. And so, according to this story in the Talmud, the son of Simeon ben Shetach, who was being led to his execution, turned to his father and said, "Father, you wish to become the salvation of Israel? See to it that my sentence is carried out. Look upon me as a doorstep over which you must pass to your great destiny without compunction." So we find the principle announced in the Talmud, Yikov Hadin et Ha'ar, let the law pierce through the mountain. The law of justice must prevail. And so great was the passion for justice in ancient Israel that in its name they dared to challenge even God himself. God himself, they affirmed, must be bound by his own laws of justice. You will recall how Abraham pleaded for the pagan city of Sodom and Gomorrah, this wicked city, hoping to save it from destruction. And he argued with the Lord. And finally he said, "Hashofet kol ha'aretz, lo yaaseh mishpat, shall the ruler of the whole world himself not do justice?" Yet in spite of the truly exalted conception of justice which we find in the Bible and among the rabbis, nowhere do we find a definition which could help us in determining just exactly what justice is. What is the essence of justice? Perhaps such a definition is not to be had. But we may come close to it. We may approximate an understanding of ideal justice if we ask ourselves, what is the goal of justice in society? What does justice aim to accomplish for society? And I suppose that here we can all agree that the aim of justice is to make possible a good society in which all men may develop their talents and their capacities freely and fully. A good society is one in which every man does what he wishes to do, but wishes to do only that which will contribute to the happiness of others as well as to his own. Ideal justice then aims to ensure what you might call responsible freedom for all men, which will help all men to build the good society for all. Ideal justice is that which grants a man freedom to develop his capacities to the utmost. A man who is equipped to become a first-rate mechanic And in the economy of God's world, a first-rate mechanic is as important as a first-rate musician. Society ought to make it possible for him to develop himself in that capacity to the utmost. And the way to make this possible is to afford him the opportunities of education, of training, to put no roadblocks in his way, no discriminatory roadblocks in his way. If a man is endowed to become a great musician, society ought to make it possible for him to develop his gifts. And whether he belongs to this or that class, to this or that race or religion, does not matter. Society must see to it that such considerations, race, religion, creed, class, should in no way interfere with the free unfoldment of that man's talent or career. In other words, ideal justice demands that every man should be given not an equal share, but an equal chance. A chance to realize all the latent potentialities, latent abilities of his being, regardless of color, or creed, or ancestry. Every man should be free to develop himself to the utmost limits of his abilities. Now, from this tentative definition, not an absolute definition, many revolutionary implications flow from this definition. If justice means freedom to develop within a good society, granting the same right and privilege to everyone else, if justice means freedom to develop, then everything which keeps a man from enjoying that freedom is injustice. Now, what are some of the things which keep a man from enjoying that freedom? In the first place, poverty. You've heard it often said that poverty is a spur to ambition, that great need incites to greater effort. Well, that is true up to a certain point. A pinch of poverty may prove a stimulus, but continuous, crushing want, poverty, will starve and stultify human personality and ultimately destroy it. There's very little to be said for poverty. Poverty is a form of slavery. It's the prison house. Want is so many shackles placed upon the human spirit. Oh, here and there, some extraordinary person will break through the confinements of his environment, rise above them. But for most men, continuous, long-enduring poverty is not a stimulus, but a stultifying condition. Therefore, a society which is pursuing the ideal of justice will set about to put an end to poverty by increasing the social goods and by distributing these social goods equitably. The task of a society which aims to establish ideal justice is to eradicate poverty, and to eradicate it not by charity, not by philanthropy, not by doling out gifts to the poor, but by establishing an economic order where every man who labors will receive a fair recompense for his labor and will have enough to protect himself and his family against want, against sickness, against the material disabilities of old age. The destruction of poverty is the first requisite of the establishment of ideal justice among men. And the other factor which makes for injustice is unearned wealth. The only justification for our present economic system is the merit system. Unearned wealth destroys the merit system, and by so doing destroys justice in society. No man who does not contribute to the assets of society should be privileged to draw upon the treasures of society. There ought to be, if not a rigid, at least a fair correlation between service and reward, or the whole system becomes infamously unjust. Now, how can you determine whether a given act is ideally just? How can you tell whether an act which you have performed or about to perform is just? Ask yourself, does this act represent responsible freedom in me? Does it represent me in my capacity as a free agent working for the common good, or does it not? If it does, then it is a just act. If it does not, it represents me at the lower levels of my enslavement to passions, to lust, to desires, to cupidities, to envies. Then it is an unjust act. And the way to determine whether I'm doing the right thing is to ask myself, suppose every other living human being would do the same thing. What would happen? That is the test which you may recall the great philosopher Immanuel Kant set. If you have any question about the act that you're about to perform, if you want to know whether this is right or wrong, universalize your act. Say to yourself, suppose every living human being would do the same thing. Would it contribute to social well-being? Or would it not? And long before this philosopher, Kant, the great rabbi, Hillel, the great Hillel set the same test. That which is hateful unto thyself, do not do to your neighbor. Ask yourself whether the act which you're about to do would be congenial to you if someone else did it to you. Would it contribute to your well-being? Now, both of these tests are valid tests. Perhaps Hillel's is a more practical one. You may not know how a given act will affect humanity, but you pretty well know how a given act will affect you. If you're about to rob your working man of his just hire, for example, put yourself in his place and ask yourself, if I were the working man and this act were perpetrated upon me, would I like it? Would I regard it as just? Now, if this is, roughly speaking, ideal justice, responsible freedom for all men, what is ideal love? Love is the supreme motive in human life, and ideal justice is its supreme instrument. Quite difficult to define or analyze a sentiment as complex as love. It baffles all description and all analysis, and yet there is no doubt about its reality or its potency when one experiences it. Of all motives in human life, love is the most powerful. The author of that marvelous love lyric in the Bible, the Song of Songs, says, Love is as strong as death. Its flashes are flashes of fire. It is the very flame of God. Now, there are many other motives in human life besides love. There is ambition, there is hate, there is fear, there is compassion. But the motive which produces the noblest results, whether in art or literature or religion or character, in families or in society, is unselfish love. And it is the supreme achievement of the human race. Now, whether or not unselfish love is an original endowment of the human race is really of little moment. We might be able to trace back this love of which I speak to its very humble beginnings in physical and material considerations. But that would make no difference at all. For the beginning of a thing is not the thing itself. The mighty oak tree begins in the acorn. But the oak tree is infinitely more than the acorn. Cynics are frequently tempted to deprecate the value of a human institution by pointing to its humble origin. But that is fallacious reasoning. An institution should be judged on the basis of its value at the time that it's being judged, and not on what its beginnings were. It is folly, for example, to run down a great man or to deprecate his importance by pointing out that once upon a time that great man was a helpless, drooling infant. Now, we know that there is such a thing as disinterested love in the world. And when we see it in action, we stand before it as before a holy thing, wrapped in adoration. Now, there is this to be said about ideal love, about true love, but it is never without its compensations. But compensation is never the motive of real love. No one loves truly in the thought of receiving a reward. The mother who loves her child, the man who loves his friend, the idealist who lives for his ideal, they're not thinking in terms of possible rewards. In fact, they would not know what you're talking about if you speak to them about a reward for their love. They love because it is the most necessary, the most desirable, and altogether the most spontaneous thing in the world for them. But while compensation is not the motive of real love, it inevitably follows real love. Now, the compensation of real love is inner joy. He who loves finds joy in the object which he loves. Real love is encompassing joyousness. The love of her child makes the heart of a mother sing for joy. Now, this does not mean there are no great sorrows and anguish in the lives of those who love. There are. Are the inescapable sorrows which are part of our common human destiny. But true love rejoices in the object which it loves. The love of knowledge, the love of beauty, the love of God is an inexhaustible source of inner joy. I rejoiced when they said unto me, come, let us go into the house of the Lord. And the greater the love, the higher the ecstasy of joy. And here, perhaps, my friends, is the first real test of love. Do you find joy in the object which you love? Without an element of happiness, there is no love. You may respect, you may admire, you may tolerate. But if you do not find exquisite joy, you do not love. Marriage, for example, or friendship, or the pursuit of knowledge, or philanthropy, or the love of God, in fact, every emotion which you assume to be based on the sentiment of love, which does not bring with it an overwhelming sense of joy, is not the real thing. It is a plaster imitation of it. I repeat again that this fact does not preclude the possibility or even the probability of great grief, tragedy sometimes. There are many eddies, cross currents on the tides of life. But love is the deep channel which carries the river of life steady and strong to its appointed destiny. And because real love brings great joy, it is powerful. It is all powerful. Now, sorrow and grief, they contract, they enfeeble, they inhibit. Sorrow oftentimes paralyzes our power of volition and of action. But joy releases energy. Happiness is really the dynamics of inspiration. The rabbis were profoundly wise when they said that inspiration does not come to a man who is depressed. And this brings me to the second half of the statement which I gave you at the outset. Love is a supreme motive of human life. And ideal justice is the supreme instrument of love. Great love, my friends, works through great justice. Now, very often a distinction is made between love and justice. Theologians are often fond of making such a distinction. Apologists for this or that religion are given to drawing this rather artificial distinction. It is said, for example, that the religion of Israel is a religion based on rigid justice, that Christianity came into the world to teach man a new principle, a principle of love. This is an unreal distinction, because there can be no real love without justice, and there can be no real justice without love. We cannot be just if we are not kind-hearted, and we cannot be kind-hearted if we are not just. Love which does not work through the channel of justice. And here again, I remind you that I'm speaking not of legal justice, of jural justice, of court justice, of the ideal justice of human life. Love which does not seek to express itself through justice very frequently becomes a serious roadblock in human life. Love can often become very clannish. Love is also in danger of being unreflective and impulsive. You see a poor man, you sympathize with him, you pity him, you give him alms. That impulsive giving may do him more harm than good. It may be socially harmful. Love will frequently condone and be lenient when it should be corrective. I am ready to accept Paul's great dictum that love is the greatest thing in the world, but only when it is qualified by the idea that justice is its supreme instrument. I cannot subscribe to that other dictum, which is a tribute to the master of Christianity, love thine enemy. In the first place, that is psychologically impossible. We cannot love our enemies. And it is not wise that we should love our enemies. We ought to be just to our enemies. We ought not to hate our enemies. But we should try to check their power to do evil and to persuade them, if at all possible, that they should cease to be our enemies. Thou shalt rebuke a man and not bear a grudge against him. Great love, I repeat, works through great justice. The man who loves mankind, for example, will not remain content with mere charity, charitable impulses, mere disposition, kindly. He will set out to help bring about a full measure of justice in society, which will make his charity unnecessary. It is not enough to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, to pity the unfortunate. Great love demands that we should devote our energies to the reconstruction of society so as to prevent hunger and want and misery among men, to restore every child of God to his divine patrimony, to enable every man to live under his vine and under his fig tree with none to make him afraid, to make it unnecessary for a human being to come knocking at one's doors for alms. The greatest love works through the greatest justice. I do not crave the privilege of doling out alms to the poor in order to express my love for mankind. Great love also develops what I call responsible freedom in the object of one's love. A man and a woman who are deeply in love will not seek to subject one to the other or to drain one's personality in order to feed the other. They will make possible the fullest development of each in the comradeship of freedom. A man who is a real friend will not try to make of his friend a reflex of himself, an echo of himself, but he will try to develop both himself and his friend into the fullest freedom. Each one living his own life, developing his own capacities, yet helping one another to grow. And this brings me to the second test of real love. The first test is joy. The second test is growth. A love which does not stimulate growth and unfoldment in the person one loves is not love at all. Young people who are truly in love with one another will find in their love a stimulation to the best that is in both of them. It will evoke the strongest and the finest in them. And when husband and wife deeply love, they will go through life growing and developing, refining and upreaching all through their lives. One of the great tragedies of married life is just this, that married folks settle down to a pedestrian kind of existence, they stop growing. And very often the one who stops growing first drags the other one down. True human fellowship is an inspiration to growth. Iron sharpeneth iron, you read in the Bible. And so does a man's friend. And that is true of every human relationship. The husband who looks upon his wife as only an annex to his own personality, as a convenient foil to his own life, is not truly in love. True love asks for an even greater measure of responsible freedom in the object which is loved than in itself. Many parents are ultimately left without the love of their children because they fail to develop them into the responsible obligation, the freedom, because of too much unreflective love for them. Many parents are cruel to their children unintentionally when they're overly protective. They keep their children from developing into responsible freedom, either by overly protecting them, by overly shielding them, by overly indulging them, or by attempting to dictate too long and too often to them, out of their love, of course. Our rabbi said, God loved Israel greatly, therefore he gave Israel the Torah and many mitzvot, many commandments, many ordinances. God manifested his love for his people, not by indulging them, but by permitting them to develop freely through many obligations and responsibilities. And this is the very essence of love. Love is truly the driving impulse of all the noble adventures in human life. It lends all color and charm to human existence. It robs sorrow of its sting. It heals wounds. It softens the harshness of all experiences. It makes life a joyous and eager pilgrimage, but only when it expresses itself through supreme justice, justice to ourselves and to those whom we love. True love does not indulge, does not cater, does not exploit, does not make unreasonable demands. True love is strong and oftentimes exacting, but it always seeks the happiness and the joy of the object loved. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is true of all love, sacred or profane, for there really is no profane love. All true love is sacred because all true love is of God.